I don't have a lot of time, so I'm going to jump right in here. Just wanted to acknowledge my co-authors. We're all part of the Sustainable Intensification Innovation Lab, one of the Feed the Future Innovation Labs at Kansas State University, and have all contributed to this presentation. So some of the topics I'd like to cover in my 20 minutes is just talk a little bit about the complexity of micronutrient nutrition with an emphasis on smallholder farmers, which is an emphasis of our innovation lab. Critical soil chemical reactions, processes, and characteristics that influence micronutrient uptake by plants. And have a little bit of focus on zinc and iron. And then we'll talk about the potential impact of sustainable intensification on micronutrient nutrition for smallholder farmers. A little bit of future looking, what are our research needs, and then conclude this. So there's a couple of overriding things that I want to touch on. One is that, you know, this is a crop science division. I know it's transdisciplinary, but if you're a soil scientist, you may not be all that enthralled by the soil science that I'm going to present because you're not my audience. The second thing is that I really want all of us to be thinking very broadly about the topic of improving human nutrition with the idea that we all tend to work in our little silos, you know, soil science, crop science, et cetera, human nutrition even. And if we're going to make progress on this, we need to be thinking broadly about what are all the barriers that prevent us from improving human nutrition. So soils, obviously, as a soil scientist, very important, but I have to recognize it's not the only way to go about this. So I also wanted to point out that we're really in a tremendous time for this topic. And just a few examples here, International Decade of Soils, Year of Pulses, the Decade of Nutrition. There's a lot of attention on this whole sort of soil to human nutrition nexus, and we need to capitalize on that and make a lot of advances. So I want to just go a little bit about some human nutrition factors. In developing countries, it is about both energy and nutrition, calories plus the nutritional components. And we can't forget that, because just supplying calories, you know, if you're going to double or triple the yields of rice and that is their only source of calories, you're really not going to help nutrition overall. The other thing that we forget sometimes is that food insecurity has many different types, many different flavors, if you will. You know, acute versus chronic, seasonal, the hunger season that you hear about. And then sometimes when we have adequate calories, we have subclinical nutrient deficiencies that are really holding things back. And in the developing countries, we look for some rather what I call egregious examples of malnutrition. So dangerously thin for one's height, clinical deficiencies in things like zinc, iron, iodine and vitamin A, which worldwide are the four most important, underweight for age and stunting. And if you look at some of the nutrition statistics for some countries, it's really quite astounding that, for example, you could have up to 45% of the children that are stunted because of malnutrition in a country. If you think about that, it makes a little bit of sense, because as a child is developing, of course, there are critical growth stages, and all it takes is malnourishment in short periods of time to have lifelong impacts. But also think about that from walking through an elementary school in the United States, for example. If you were to see something like this, surely you would want to do something about it. And it's really no different no matter where you are in the world. Some additional considerations from a nutritional standpoint. Pretty well accepted that dietary diversity generally enhances nutrition. So you hear that all the time, diversify the diet. In some diets in countries where 85% of the calories come from a single staple food, you can see lots of opportunities to diversify. However, in the aspect of sustainable intensification, where we're often intensifying through more crops, it does not necessarily enhance dietary diversity. So we have to keep that in mind. Sometimes the cash that's raised is used for other things and doesn't necessarily flow back into increases in nutrition. We also have to keep in mind that things like processes and preparation methods can have profound impacts on micronutrient content, bioavailability. So simple things like milling grain, removing the bran, has a huge impact on the micronutrient availability. And there again, we're going to talk about zinc and iron just for the sake of time. So I like to capture the flow of micronutrients and really any nutrients from the soil into humans with this diagram. course, starting in the soil, flowing to the plants, and then arriving in humans by a variety of pathways. Can be consumed directly by animals, and then we consume those animals or those animal products, so dairy, eggs, things like that. We can take those plants and turn them into feed, which then go to animals and come this way, or we can process that food in various ways before we reach it, and then, of course, we can consume the plants directly ourselves. Perhaps a statement of the obvious, but we lose sight of that sometime. And where I have the asterisks is here, again, that big picture, we want to improve human nutrition. All of these are entry points for micronutrients into the human food chain. And then the other issue is that of bioavailability, way more than we can cover here today, but it enters at every step in the process. And I'll talk a little bit about the bioavailability of nutrients in the soil to the plants, but you could take that all the way to the human side. The bioavailability of iron in spinach is much different than the bioavailability of iron in red meat, for example, once you have ingested those food materials. And then if you look at these steps individually, with the soil, of course, it's the total quantity of nutrients or micronutrients that are present in the soil. We can't be continually depleting the soil. Any of you who are at the ASA breakfast this morning and heard Scott Engel talk, he went over this very nicely. The bioavailability issue, the whole nutrient cycling, we have to be aware of where those plant-available nutrients exist. And in many low fertility situations, a lot of that nutrient cycling occurs in the organic matter and through crop residue decomposition and those sorts of things. And then, of course, fertilization, that's where we can enter nutrients. And by fertilization, I mean any source, not just inorganic fertilizers, manures, compost, anything that adds nutrients to the soil. We look at the plants, of course, they get their nutrients from the soil. Lots of rhizosphere and microbiome effects. The microbiome effects we're just starting to understand a little bit better in terms of rhizosphere. We have to recognize that plants can alter the soil environment to their advantage for uptake of nutrients. And another entry point here, we can do foliar feeding of nutrients and get those into the system. You look at the animals, of course, they're getting their forages and feed, and the content of that influences their nutrition. Microbiome effects and bioavailability are here as well. We can supplement the diets of those animals, and then those nutrients get into our food chain. And then we have opportunities for fortification. So vitamin D in milk, for example, is an effort to increase our vitamin uptake. And the processed food and ingredients in feed, again, there's that loss of nutritional value. Our processing, our cooking, our milling processes have a huge impact on nutritional value and more opportunities for fortification. So iron in flour, iodine in salt are ways that we get those nutrients into the system. And then humans, of course, the bioavailability, already talked about that, microbiome effects that we're studying. And we can all take a multivitamin tablet every day. And sometimes you wonder, why can't we just do that for the 800 million people that are chronically malnourished? And it's not as simple as it sounds. And again, I'm trying to get us to think outside of our disciplines and ask questions to why that might be. So getting into the soils, what I consider to be the critical soil reactions or processes for food security, this issue of bioavailability, I'll just talk about the soil component, things like soil reaction, acidity and basicity and how that influences availability of micronutrients, low soil organic carbon content, phosphorus fixation, low cation exchange capacity. Don't have time to go through all of these, but if you look at the global picture, these are some of the issues that limit food production, both in terms of the quantity produced, which directly translates into calories, as well as the nutritional yield, so the amount of nutrients that are available for the population. So for bioavailability, I like to use this diagram, which is very general. It can be used for anything from soil contaminants and how they might have a negative effect to, in our case, micronutrients. Really, all the action is in the soil solution here in terms of this is where the plants derive their plant-available nutrients. And a lot of interactions that I've captured here with sorption and desorption as the names of the processes, but it's precipitation of insoluble minerals or dissolution of those minerals, the weathering reactions, adsorption reactions that control this transition right here. We mentioned about cycling of organic matter and soil nutrient cycles. In some cases, it's a lot of the organic forms and the mineralization and immobilization. Our organism here is a plant, so we're interested in the roots. The roots can grow towards the nutrients. Nutrients can sometimes flow towards the roots, and root characteristics are important. And there again, those plants can sometimes have an influence on these by having a different root structure or different root exudates that might influence either the microbiome or directly influence the chemistry by chelating metals and making them available. And then once it gets into the organism, it has to cross a membrane. So getting it to the root is not sufficient. You have to get it into the organism. And then it has to get into a component of that that we're interested in. So the biological response here would be deposition in the grain or some other edible portion of the plant that is going to enter our food chain. Looking at the soil reaction, both low pH and high pH can have an influence. In the case of low pH, we have maximum cation bioavailability at low pH, so zinc and iron would be two great examples. Copper would be another, manganese, and then as pH goes up, generally the bioavailability of these goes down. And this is the inset diagram is a percent exchangeable zinc in what we call a sequential fraction extreme, as that influenced by pH. So here you see at very acidic pHs, less than 5, that 20 to 50% of the zinc in the soil solution will be available, or in the soil, I should say. And as you get up above pH 7, that drops off dramatically. So that has a big impact as we manage these soils. pH is very easy to manage. We know how to do it, but sometimes things like lime availability have an overriding impact that we can't overcome because of economics. Highest soil pH, there's micronutrient deficiency, so the opposite occurs. Iron deficiency, very common on high pH soils, and zinc deficiency, and it may indicate some other issues like salinity, sodicity, or the presence of free carbonates. So a lot of global maps of soil pH, and I just use this one, fairly recent, based on the balance of precipitation and evapotranspiration, and clearly indicates some areas with very, very acidic soils across many of the areas where we assume we have lots of hunger, but then also areas, particularly in the more arid regions, where we have very high pHs, and we have micronutrient deficiencies on the other end of the pH scale. Looking a little bit more closely at zinc and iron, the bioavailability from the soils to plants is strongly influenced by soil pH, and I'll illustrate that a little bit more here in a second. The bioavailability in food upon ingestion is influenced by multiple factors, more important for iron than zinc, as I've already talked about with the spinach and red meat example. Iron is redox sensitive. That has a lot of influence for things like rice production, where we're growing these under a reduced environment. Total concentration of iron in soils is much higher than zinc on average, so we're never really deficient in iron in the sense of the total amount of there, but we're often deficient in the sense of how much is available for plant uptake, and that can be true with zinc as well. So the solubility of the soil iron minerals, much, much lower than that for zinc, illustrated here at the bottom, where we have two very common soil minerals, hematite for iron and willemite for zinc. These are the predicted free iron or zinc ion activities at a pH of 5 and a pH of 7. For hematite, you see 10 to the minus 15th. That's a very low, very, very low number. You take that up to pH of 7, so you increase it only by 2, and you reduce the availability by 6 orders of magnitude. Okay, so that gives you some idea of the pH effect. Not quite so dramatic with zinc. You have both a higher equilibrium metal concentration, 10 to the minus 2 versus 10 to the minus 15, and then when you increase the pH by a couple of units, you're really only changing by 3 orders of magnitude instead of 6. So some very significant differences in chemistry that lead to some other things, such as the fact that soil applications of inorganic iron salts are generally not effective. And it's because they're precipitated as very, very insoluble minerals that are not available to the plants, all right? We can use things like chelates, iron, EDTA, those sorts of things, but they're very expensive, so that creates an economic barrier to their use, in particularly in developing countries. And foliar applications work for both, which is a good thing, but those present some challenges too in terms of getting them applied at the right time. And to set the stage for our next speaker, I've taken some data on wheat grain zinc concentrations from CatMac, and just showing the top graph showing no applied zinc, no soil zinc. Here is soil zinc, and here is soil plus foliar zinc. You can see the stair step effect, and then here's a zinc rate effect. You can see from 0 up to 21 kilograms per hectare, a nice increase in the zinc concentration in the grain. So there's a review published recently, Joy et al. In 2015, where they looked at agronomic biofortification for three different crops, maize, rice, and wheat, either micronutrients either applied by the soil or a foliar, a number of studies reviewed. The main point is over here, compared to a control, so where we haven't added any zinc, the numbers range from 111% increase in the zinc content of rice to 178% increase in wheat for foliar applications. And that gives us some sense of what the potential is. And if you look at genetic biofortification, I think a doubling is a reasonable amount, if not a little bit more. So again, to put that into perspective. We also have to realize that the genetics do play a component. This is a data set published from wheat cultivars that were released in the state of Kansas going back to the 1880s with Turkey Red, the original hard red winter wheat, and looking at the zinc and iron content over time. And yes, if you take out these points, those slopes are still negative. And this is related more to the introduction of the semi-dwarf wheat varieties, where there's a little bit of dilution of that. Steve McGrath is here. He presented some great data on this from Rothamsted yesterday, showing the same effect. So there is some evidence for some crops where the nutritional content is going down over time. So now I want to talk a little bit about sustainable intensification and the framework that we use. It's a cycle. We have inputs up here, direct inputs such as fertilizers, hopefully intensifying either through increasing the production of single crops or introduction of additional crops. The outputs that we're interested in here obviously are production, but also income and also nutrition. Okay, so it's not just about producing more rice, it's about more nutrition overall and reducing poverty. So I've taken some studies out of the literature and looked at the effect of sustainable intensification on micronutrient yields and potential micronutrient diet scenarios. So here, SNAP et al. In 2010, two different locations. Basically, they've taken maize, produced traditional ways, added nitrogen, and then either in rotation or intercropped with various legumes. The main point is for both zinc and iron, if just simply adding nitrogen because we're increasing the yield of the crop, not necessarily decreasing the content very much, we get a doubling of the amount of zinc that's in the food system, so the uptake or the yield. And then introducing these legumes helps also compared to the control, but there's added advantages. We're also introducing or increasing the protein yield. A second study looking at conventional agricultural practices, or I'm sorry, conservation agricultural practices. So this includes using integrated soil fertility management, other practices, and you see a pretty big bump again in our zinc and iron yields because of that at two different locations. And where it really gets interesting is then we talk about biofortification and what are some potential strategies for doing that. And what I've done here is taken those previous studies and looked at a diet that is completely maize, which is not very realistic, but using standard energy consumption values. And then for the rest of these, I've substituted some of those calories or replaced them with the legumes and then looked at the zinc relative to the recommended daily allowance. So with a maize diet, you don't quite make your zinc requirement. But with most of these, when you've inserted that legume, you do make it or nearly make it. And there again, you've added protein. If you look at, if we take a biofortification where we've doubled the content, the zinc content, you see that you very nicely can make your recommended daily allowance. So the result here is that doubling these would be better than doubling that because here we're adding protein and meeting our zinc requirements. And then looking at another scenario, this is more typical of rice growing areas, particularly in Asia, where we're trying to add vegetables to a rice rotation. So here's a series of vegetables that are typical in Asia. Not very good on the zinc and iron. So even with that intensification or the diversification of the crops, we're not getting a lot more zinc or iron into the diet. So there you say if we double the amount of zinc in the rice alone and leave the vegetables alone, you meet your recommended daily requirement. So again, a different strategy, but having a beneficial effect. This slide just shows some of the different sources of plant nutrients and how they influence grain zinc concentration and grain zinc uptake, so it does make a difference. And a couple comments on agronomic considerations. The influence of fertilization and conservation agriculture practices on micronutrient content, grains, and pulses is largely unknown. We don't measure it enough. Agronomic biofortification has potential, probably more for zinc than it does for other micros like iron. And the yield effects on micronutrient content of grains and pulses is quite variable, so you need to be careful what you're doing there. Summarize and conclusion, it's a complex issue and it crosses many disciplines, and my encouragement to you is to reach out to those other disciplines. There are multiple entry points, multiple ways to solve this problem. Legumes are a substantially improved micronutrient nutrition and add protein to the diet, and it clearly is an emerging area of research and education. So, thank you.